You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about the work of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection, including questions about presidential records. But now, it can be hard to find a good bagel in Wisconsin. In many communities, you know, your only option is what you can find in that frozen food section of your grocery store, maybe a gas station. But our guest today wants to change that and help us make New York deli quality bagels in our own homes with sweet and savory spreads and toppings to boot. Have you made bagels at home before? What's worked well for you? What hasn't? You can join in 800-642-1234. You can email us ideas@wpr.org. Joining us now, Kathy Barrow, food writer and author of a new cookbook, Bagels, Schmears, and a Nice Piece of Fish, a whole brunch of recipes to make at home. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Molly. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. Your book goes into some of your family history with food and your heritage. What has bagels meant to you?
Bagels have been central to my family's celebrations since I can remember. Every family get-together, most Sundays, certainly weddings, bat mitzvahs, bar mitzvahs, all of it, there were always bagels there.
And I know some folks may be wondering, and some folks may be being me, is it worth all of the time and attention and the trouble to really make a wonderful bagel? How long does it take?
Well, it takes about 20 minutes in the evening to mix the dough and form the bagels. And then it takes about 20 active minutes in the morning to boil them and put them in the oven. And in 16 minutes, once they've gotten into that hot oven, you'll have a beautiful bagel as though you just walked out of a New York bagel bakery.
Okay, you're making it sound easy.
It's very easy.
So how do we do it? Where do we start?
Well, we start with the central ingredient, which is high gluten flour. This is not a usual flour. It has a very high protein content, and that is what contributes to the very shiny, crackly exterior shell on a good bagel. And in order to get that high gluten flour, we have a couple of options. One is to mail order it from a variety of baking sources, but most often from King Arthur up in Vermont. And if you don't want to do that, you can add a product called Vital Wheat Gluten Flour, which is available everywhere and is very reasonably priced. And you add 2 teaspoons to a cup of all-purpose flour, and you've created that same high protein content that will give you a perfect bagel.
Okay, so we've got the high gluten flour, but what about water? Clear this up for me, because I have heard people say that the quality of your water makes a difference. Where do you come down on that?
I don't know who perpetuated that falsehood, but let me tell you that once, many, many years ago, in order to test a theory, I brought back a bottle of water from New York City, and I tried making bagels, and they just were terrible. So I don't think it has anything to do with the water. It had to do with the fact that I didn't know about high gluten flour at the time. And once I learned about that, it all worked out. Your water will not make a difference, and it doesn't make a difference if it's warm or cold or room temperature when it goes into the mixer.
Okay. So any water will do. High gluten flour. What else?
Well, I like to use a yeast that is called SAF Instant Yeast. And this was a product that was widely available for professional bakers for a long time. And now it's available to home bakers. And it is instant, which means that rather than put that yeast in warm water and worry about whether you're getting enough bubbles, you know, that moment when you like sprinkle the yeast over the warm water and look at it and say, is it alive? Is it bubbling? Instant yeast stirs directly into the dry ingredients. There's no need to bloom it, no need to worry. I love it. So I use the SAF Instant. If all you have is active dry yeast, which you get in the grocery store, that's just fine. You can use that too, but do bloom it first in a little bit of the water. And do not use rapid rise yeast. That just doesn't work.
Okay. So high gluten flour, water, yeast. Any other secrets?
Two more ingredients. See, it's only five ingredients. The fourth one is salt. I use Diamond Crystal salt, that kosher salt, and it has a sort of large crystal and a good bright salty taste. If you are at home that uses Morton's kosher salt, you'll want to use about half as much. Sea salt is fine. I try to avoid iodized table salt when I'm using any yeast. And the fifth product, the fifth ingredient is barley malt syrup. Now, this is what gives bagels that malty, rich, sweet, yummy scent and flavor. It's the smell that smacks you in the face when you open the door of a warm bagel bakery. And this is, it's very easy to find online. It's a good, often it's found in like beer supply making stores, places like that. So barley malt syrup, very sticky, kind of an annoying product to use, but you only need a tablespoon.
Okay, and specifically barley malt as opposed to any other kind of sweetener or syrup.
You know, barley malt is what makes them sort of officially bagels. It makes them smell right and taste right. But if you can't find that, I've substituted honey or maple syrup with great success.
Okay. And then you have to let the dough, once you've mixed it, once you get it, you've got to let it sit and rest overnight, right?
You do. You know, adding that sweetener to that high protein flour just makes the yeast go pow, and the bagels want to just explode like a big balloon, and they will proof in an hour. But the flavor will be like flat. There's just no time for all of the flavors to really develop. So bagels have always been traditionally proofed slowly in the refrigerator overnight. So I have a calendar, a time plan for making bagels if you want to bake them in the morning, or for making them if you want to bake them at night. And that's on one of the pages in the introduction to the book. It's useful if you don't really know what overnight means.
Yeah,
Such a weird word, isn't it?
we got a message from Kim on Facebook. She swears by the La Brea Breaker, ugh, La Brea Bakery. That's a tongue twister recipe. She says, I make the dough the day before. I give it an overnight long cool ferment in the fridge or in the winter, put it in the garage. I love hand rolling and shaping them. They freeze great. Frankly, if I have a good bagel shop nearby, Kim says, I wouldn't go to all the effort.
Oh, well, she hasn't made my bagel recipe.
And we should say it is, we have more information available on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Links to much more information about making bagels. So I'm wondering about the rolling process. So how are you, what's your technique for making them perfectly round?
Well, first of all, let's just give up the idea that they should be perfectly anything, right? If they have a hole in the center, we're good. I use one of two methods. One is the Pokum method, where you have a nice tight ball of dough that you've rolled under the palm of your hand, and you take it and press both thumbs right into the middle and tear a hole through that ball of dough. And then using your two index fingers around one another, you stretch that interior hole a little bit, put your palm, four fingers through the center of the hole, and roll it on the table a little bit to tighten that exterior shell. So that's the easiest way to do it. Now, the other way is the way you may have seen bagel rollers in shops do it, and that's to make a rope that you then Bring around your hand and seal in the middle of your palm tight, and then roll that
Yeah.
seal, that seam on the table. And there are actually people who specialize in this, the bagel rollers of New York. There's a small contingent of them. So, it takes some time to get really good at it, but every bagel's delicious. It doesn't have to be perfect.
I'm with you there. I'm with you there. We're talking about bagels, and we will be talking about lox and schmears as well with Kathy Barrow, author of a new cookbook designed to help you make New York-style deli delicacies at home. We'd love to hear from you. Are you able to find good bagels in your area? What separates a good bagel from a mediocre bagel? What kind are your favorite? Sweet, savory, let's hear about it. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking to Kathy Barrow. She wrote a new cookbook, Bagels, Schmears, and a Nice Piece of Fish, a whole bunch of recipes to make at home. I want to hear what you think. Do you have a favorite schmear, a spread, a topping for your bagel? Have you ever tried to make them at home? Let's hear about it. 1-800-642-1234. Well, Kathy, I gotta ask, for those who are gluten-free or celiac, what options do they have for bagels?
I'm very proud of the gluten-free bagel recipe in this book. I worked with a friend of mine who's a pastry chef in Washington, D.C., and after working in a bakery and then owning a bakery for many years, she developed a gluten intolerance. And so she really knows her way around gluten-free flours and helped me develop a recipe that I think is as close to my gluten-filled bagel recipe as it could be. It's very, very delicious and has that crackly exterior shell and that chew, all the things you expect from a bagel.
So what flour do you use?
Well, you use the gluten-free blend that you can find in the grocery store from either Bob's or King Arthur. They're very commonly found these days. And then there are some specialty products that you need, something called modified tapioca starch. It's sold under the name Expandex, and a couple of other ingredients that help you achieve all of that texture.
And levity as well, so that they're not dense.
Oh, they're not dense. They're not. They bounce on top of the water when you boil them before baking, just like a regular bagel. It's really quite remarkable.
Interesting. I will check that out. Now, when it comes to spreads, you start with a master schmear recipe that serves as your base. How do you,
Yes.
yeah, tell me about that.
So I know that a lot of people like to buy whipped cream cheese because it's easier to spread on your bagel and it's a pleasing texture. But for me, that product has too many stabilizers and other products added to what is, basically a beautiful dairy product. Speaking to all of you out there in Wisconsin, I mean, I love cream cheese, but if I wanted to have that nice texture, I use a trick that my great grandmother taught me, and that's to add just a little bit of sour cream and a little bit of lemon juice, and then beat the cream cheese with a spoon until it's nice and soft and fluffy. And that gives you exactly what you expect when you open that whipped cream cheese, but it doesn't have any of the stuff in it. And that then becomes the base for a couple dozen opportunities for schmears, and they could either be savory, with chive or some of your leftover lox or olives or vegetables, and or sweet. Like I have a cannoli cream cheese that's really delicious with mini chocolate chips and candied orange peel,
Ooh.
and yeah, that's good. Dried apricot, thyme. I mean, there are a lot of really nice choices.
And so, do you prefer to put the toppings in your spreads as opposed to the bagel themselves? Where do you come down on ingredients in bagels, adding things?
Well, there are two sections in the bagel part of my book. One is classic bagels, those that I'm most familiar with. And then another section is called Bagels My Grandmother Wouldn't Recognize. And
Right.
that's the one that includes the bagels that have things in them. I mean, there's a sun-dried tomato and Kalamata olive bagel that is the best sandwich bagel you've ever had. It's so good. Even just melting a piece of provolone cheese on top of that makes it a party. So I think there's a place for ingredients in bagels. And if you'd asked me that 2 years ago, I would have given you a big side eye. But I've moved, you know, I've changed, I've learned. I think it's a big thing.
I love it. I love it. Well, I want to go to the phones where we have Timothy from Minnesota standing by to join us. Good afternoon, Timothy. What's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon. I actually had a question about what you were just talking about, really kind of making the leap from different kinds of spreads or schmears for bagels to ingredients. I think my experience, I was in New York City a few years ago, and I think I went to Katz Deli, and the bagels they were serving there were full of ingredients, and I guess I was shocked because, you know, it was kind of like the sky's the limit in terms of what they would put, you know, and these kind of came out like sandwiches. So, but hearing that you divided your book that way, when did you recognize that that was kind of, you know, the division, or I guess, what have you learned since you started kind of working with it that way?
Ooh, good question.
That's a great question. You know, I knew that I wanted to have a chapter on sandwiches. And as I started to think about great sandwich, my life in great sandwiches, there were some that I remembered on, flavored breads like sourdough with olives in it or things like that, that made me think there was a place for bagels to be the same, you know, to have all those nice ingredients. There's a granola bagel. I really wasn't sure about it, but I thought I'd give it a try. And it's become one of our house favorites. It's just yummy. It's got like cinnamon and oats and lots of little pieces of nuts. It's a wonderful bagel. So I'm surprised.
So you're actually throwing those ingredients directly into the bagel when you mix them?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. See, I am a classic sesame. I don't know. I don't know if I can be moved.
Well, it's worth trying. I move people I never thought would move, honestly. My former editor was one of the people who tested some of these recipes. And I would send her a recipe for like a blueberry bagel. And she'd send back a note and say, no. I'd say, come on, just try. And then she did, and she liked it. So you never know.
That must have been a fun perk of the job.
It was a very fun perk.
Well, I got to ask about storage, because after you go through making these beautiful, wonderful, fresh bagels, how do you actually keep them fresh?
Well, first, I'm very happy. I worked really hard to make all of the bagel recipes yield only 6 bagels, which to me seems like a reasonable number. I live in a household with one other person, and it takes a long time to go through 12, but 6 is good. So within 4 hours of baking your bagels, if you can wrap them up and put them directly in the freezer without slicing them, they will stay fresh for up to 3 months. Now, you reconstitute them by preheating your oven, or I use my toaster oven, to 350 degrees. When it's preheated, put a frozen bagel directly on the rack for 10 minutes, and it's as though you just baked that bagel.
Okay. And we've got
the same thing is true if you're buying commercial bagels. Let me just say that.
We've got some emails for you coming in. Grant asks, he says, I've been baking bagels for many years, but I've never used bagel boards. How do you properly use them? What do you suggest?
So in a commercial bagel bakery, bagels are placed on long rectangular pieces of wood, and then they're flipped over halfway through baking so that they bake on both the top and the bottom. And the bagels are usually baked in what's called a deck oven. You know them from pizzerias, where most of the heat comes from the top, and that's why a bagel board is required. Now, I was trying to figure out if I had to flip my bagels over. And that's when my husband named everything Spice, everywhere Spice. Because when I flipped them over, I got sesame seeds and everything else all over the oven and the kitchen. And it was a bad idea from the get-go, I just have to say. So instead, I bake bagels on a hot surface. I take them from the boiling water, put them on parchment that's sitting on a pizza peel. I add my seeds, but I sprinkle seeds on very generously. And then I slide that parchment directly onto a baking steel, which is an all-metal version of a pizza stone. If you don't have either of those, flip a baking sheet over and heat it up with the oven so that you have a screaming hot surface underneath the bagel, and you slide that parchment on it, your bagels are going to cook on the underside as well as on the top.
Gotcha. Well, I've got to ask before we let you go, what is your current favorite bagel?
My current favorite has never changed. It's an everything bagel, untoasted, chive cream cheese, a thin slice of tomato, only in season, a nice hefty portion of lox, some capers, and a little bit of ground pepper.
Oof. Thank you, Kathy.
Hungry now, right?
Right. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Molly.
Kathy Barrow is a food writer and author of the new cookbook, Bagels, Schmears, and a Nice Piece of Fish, a whole brunch of recipes to make at home. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking about the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol insurrection on January 6th. The group is aiming to begin public hearings next month, and a final report from the committee is anticipated in the fall. Just in time for midterm elections, right? We're going to talk about the latest from this committee, including controversial presidential phone logs from January 6th. And while we're on this subject of producing records, we'll discuss Assembly Speaker Robin Voss being held in contempt for not handing over some of his own. We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. What do you think the outcome of all of this will be? What should it be? 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joining us is Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time. Susan, I'm not hearing you. Are you with us?
I am.
Oh, great. Fantastic. Well, we want to talk about this House Select Committee. Its work has been ongoing since last summer. Remind us of its goal.
The committee was established by the House of Representatives to investigate the events that took place on January 6th.
And what was it initially focused on? And have you seen that focus change?
Well, I would say that initially it was looking at the events of January 6th, looking for different people who were involved in the insurrection, looking to see the role that the president, former President Trump, may or may not have had. It was looking to see whether or not it would encourage criminal prosecutions through the Justice Department. And, you know, the interesting thing is that as it's gotten going, it's uncovered more things that have then led it down different paths. So it's hard to say when a committee like this is established. It's not that the charge is so super specific that you know where it's necessarily going to lead. So, I mean, the umbrella there is January 6th and the different things that happened. And then as one door opens, another door opens.
Right, right. We've seen the Trump aides, senior staff, now family members, some cooperating before the committee, some refusing, being held in contempt. Are there anyone that has surprised you or stood out to you?
Well, I was interested to see that Jared Kushner, former President right. Trump's son-in-law, met with the committee virtually yesterday to speak to them about what he knows. And it was interesting. I read Benny Thompson, who is the chair of this House committee, talking about how there was helpful information that was shared and that they appreciated hearing from him and things like that. And I also have read that they are in discussions with Ivanka Trump, former President Trump's daughter. Who, mm-hmm. who also, you know, may in fact meet with them. So I think that that's been surprising as far as that goes. It was also interesting to me that former President Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, had originally engaged with the committee and shared some things, text messages and other things. That was the origin of the Ginny Thomas text messages. And so that he shared things and he was cooperating and then he stopped. So it's interesting that some people engaged with the committee and then kind of pulled back. So that's one other thing of note.
Right. And on that note, so he, you know, he was held in contempt, right? But so far, what is the status of that?
The interesting thing about the contempt when it comes from Congress is that, and you're correct, he was held in contempt in December, and there's been others since. Dan Scavino is one name that comes to mind recently. And the issue is that when someone is held in contempt of Congress, there's not necessarily a whole lot that Congress itself can do. And so it often is, it relies on the power of persuasion, let's say, to say, right. Well, look, you've been held in contempt of Congress, and we think that that should be sort of a stain on you, and we'd like you to reconsider participating, but that obviously hasn't been the case. And I think that what some are hoping is that there would be a more aggressive role for the Justice Department that obviously has a lot more authority as far as its options in this regard.
Right, right. We're speaking with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, about the January 6th Select Committee and its action. So meanwhile, there's this parallel criminal investigation going on at DOJ, and you mentioned that the actual House committee's work is, it feeds into that perhaps, but they, beyond the subpoenas, they cannot... is that where their power ends, the ability to request a subpoena and perhaps public shaming if they
right.
don't comply?
Right. And I mean, you know, what they were trying to do is compel testimony and yeah. compel the right. surrender of documents.
Right.
And so that's what they're doing I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so I'm wondering, too, you know, how significant is it that we have the 7-hour block of time during which there were no calls recorded on this official White House record?
I think it's very significant because there is a long history of presidential records being kept. And I know that's kind of, it's a very simplistic way for me to say it, but, you know, everyone went to the missing minutes on the Nixon tapes,
right?
Because that's the most notable thing that we can think of. And so the idea that we have this day that was a very active day in the life of the president, and we have this 7-hour gap where there's no phone calls, when in fact we know that people spoke to him, because there are people, for example, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy in the House, who and others who have spoken about talking to President Trump on the phone during this period of time. And so it makes a person wonder, what phone was he using? You know, were the records just not kept, or was he using burner phones or someone else's phone? I mean, what was going on? I think it's quite significant.
And so what constitutes a presidential record as far as these phone calls go?
Well, logs are kept of everything. You know, logs are kept of the phone calls. Logs are kept of who enters the White House. Logs are kept of who enters the Oval Office. And all of that, when a president, those all have to be kept, and then they are turned over to the National Archives. And there are very clear rules about how that all goes. I mean, you might recall just not too long ago, there was a controversy about classified documents that were taken back to Mar-a-Lago and not turned in to the archives when President Trump left. And so the archivists at the National Archives take that very seriously. Again, what penalty is there? There's not, for all intents and purposes. But I think that the idea that we had this gap of time where we know that the president was speaking to people, but we have no record of that, suggests that there's a reason why we have no record of that.
Right. We're talking about the work of the House Select Committee investigating the events leading up to and including January 6th, 2021. Our guest is Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Love to hear what you think. 800-642-1234. How does any of this impact how you may vote in the fall? 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about the investigations into what and who was behind the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. We're talking about questions of presidential records and other governmental records, and how this might all impact how we all vote and how future generations will look back at this period in our country's history. You can join us, 800-642-1234. Well, Susan, I want to follow up on that question of presidential records. Why are they so important?
I think they're important for a couple of reasons. I think they're important for historical purposes, just in the sense that it's important for historians and others to be able to go back and study what presidents have done. So I think that there's that. I also think that there's the transparency issue. And I think that's the more important reason, I would argue, that we're talking about someone who has been elected to the highest office in the land. And the idea is that the actions that take place in the presidency, in the White House, needs to be very carefully documented in order to ensure that things that take place are appropriate, to use them in a very simple term.
Yes. Yes, and I want to go to the phones, Susan. We've got Mark on the line that wants to join us. Mark's calling from Kendall. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, when somebody doesn't follow the laws that make our country a democracy, aren't there any penalties or anything like that? Or, you know,
Yeah. What happens? What are the consequences?
Well, I think that that's what we were getting to even earlier with this idea that there's this parallel investigation going on through the Justice Department that a lot of people are, a lot of Democrats, I would say, are frustrated, is not moving as quickly as they would like. And that's where the potential criminal penalties could come into play on a number of different levels. I just think about the practicality that when you have something like a requirement to keep the records, or President Trump removing documents from the White House, these are the kinds of things that I think were written into policy, into law, with the expectation that they would not be violated. And so there isn't necessarily a lot of precedent for how you would punish someone for something like this, for not appropriately keeping phone records, for example.
Yeah. Well, and this brings up a case close to home here in Wisconsin with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He's just been held in contempt of court for not turning over documents related to the Gableman investigation into the 2020 election here. And for his part, he says, you know, I deleted the emails. They don't exist. I can't turn up what I don't have. What do you think about that, the judge holding Speaker Voss in contempt?
Well, as far there are expectations for public officials that there's a maintenance of records, and that we turn those over to the public when they're requested. And so what we've seen is that in the case of the request of Speaker Voss in regard to the documents related to the 2020 election, what the judge has ruled is that there's been a disregard of the order, and therefore she held him in contempt of court and said that he had 14 days to turn over the records, and then there would be a fine of $1,000 per day, and that's the penalty that would be, that, you know, Mark was asking about penalties. That's the penalty that would be in place for this kind of contempt order if those records are turned over. Now, the fact is that if they don't exist, then the records can't be turned over. However, if there's a public records request, you can, you know, run the analysis on the emails to see what's there and what's not there, and then it's the response. The judge can determine what's appropriate to share and what's not appropriate to share. So, but if the records aren't there, and he's saying the records aren't there, they're not there.
Right. And on those penalties, though, I mean, when you have a sitting elected official that is charged by a judge, who actually pays those penalties?
Well, given from what I've read, that would likely be added to the cost of the investigation itself, particularly given that it's not just Speaker Voss, and it's Speaker Voss in his role as Speaker and the Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that would be added to the bill.
For taxpayers, essentially.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, I've noticed that this is, as you mentioned, this is not a common occurrence to find sitting officials held in contempt of court. Do you think we're in a new era of politics? I mean, do you think this is a trend, a start of a trend, or does this echo Nixon, and is this just a history rhyming?
No, I think that it is indicative of the era that we are in, of hyper-partisanship and this country that is so divided in their own camps. And so you don't have the kind of comedy that maybe you had in the past. I mean, I think that what we're seeing with the January 6th investigation, I'm not terribly surprised that members of the former administration are not wanting to participate in a process that they believe is illegitimate. And so that doesn't necessarily surprise me. You know, in the state of Wisconsin, as far as this goes, there's such a strong history of public records and public records disclosure that if there's nothing to show, then nothing damning to show, then I'm a bit surprised that we're seeing such a resistance to share the documents.
Well, and with the January 6th committee, I wonder what you think the ultimate impact of this report will be when they finally reach that point. You know, when we finally get to the point where they've talked to everyone they can, they've got as much data as they can possibly gather from people that will talk to them. You know, then what?
I mean, I think it's going to be an important historical document because they're doing a very thorough job of looking at what happened. And I think a lot of it depends on how much more information they're able to gather while their committee is operating. There's a lot to be said for the idea that the Republicans are really trying to just run out the clock, because there's a hope that the Republicans will win in the November election, and then the committee will, if it isn't already done, will be shut down. And so I don't see that I have a lot of hope for a big policy change or even for lots of disclosure more, and also of the criminal side of things, given how slow it's been to this point. But I think that, you know, we should do this just for the sake of doing it, because it's going to provide a lot of good information moving forward.
Yes. And we have a caller joining us now. We have Fawn in Madison on the line. Hello, Fawn.
Hi, Fawn, and hello, Molly. I have a comment, which is that this discussion really makes me more mindful that our elected representatives and officials are, in fact, public servants. And I think they need to be mindful that they are public servants. They're not just leaders. They serve the public. And in that capacity, they have obligations and duties that they need to be mindful of. So to me, that's an important point. And secondly, with regard to the disappearance of records, could it be viewed as theft and prosecuted in that manner? Thank you.
Thanks, Fawn.
To answer the second question, I don't believe it would be interpreted that way. But I agree wholeheartedly with the idea of elected officials are public servants and therefore answerable to the public.
Yeah. And on that note, I mean, do you think this will change public opinion? I mean, you mentioned we got the midterms coming up, and that could change the equation entirely. Is this changing public opinion?
I think that for some people, the more that we learn, the more likely it is for them to say, you know what, this is really more than I can accept. It could be the Ginny Thomas text. It could be the 7 hours of phone records. It could be any number of things. But I think that it's kind of the drip, drip, drip. And so I think that potentially some people's opinions could be changed, but not everyone's.
So what are you watching for next?
I'm watching to see if any of these people who have been intransigent will decide that they're going to participate in the process. And I'm also watching very closely what the Justice Department is doing.
Yes. Yes. Well, that is the time that we have today. Thank you so much, Susan, for being with us.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We talked with her about some of the latest developments in the work of the House Committee investigating January 6th. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.